from the nation's capital. This is DC Public Safety. I'm your host, Leonard Sipes. Ladies and gentlemen, we are celebrating our 150th radio show. We're currently up to 133,000 requests per month for the radio, television, blog, and transcript at media.csosa.gov. Our program today is going to be a focus on high-risk offenders with John Bunton. He is with Governing Magazine, www.governing.com. I want to focus on three particular issues during the interview. A different way of administrating the criminal justice system. Incarceration levels must be sufficient, but the real impact of an article that he wrote is a focus on the truly high-risk offenders. What John did was write an article called How Game Theory is Reinventing Crime Fighting. It is probably, in my 42 years within the criminal justice system, one of the most readable and one of the most interesting and one of the most impactful articles I've ever seen, and that's out of reading tens of thousands of articles. John Bunton, Governing Magazine, welcome to DC Public Safety.
Thank you for having me, Len.
All right, John, it's How Game Theory is Reinventing Crime Fighting. Give me an elevator speech as to what that means.
Well, we're at a really interesting moment. State and local governments have, for the past few years, been squeezed by falling revenues, by the recession. As state policymakers have stepped back and looked at their fiscal situation, they have realized something which has been obvious to those of us who've covered the criminal justice system for a while. And that is that for the past decade, corrections and healthcare costs have risen dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
20 years ago, states spent about $12 billion mm-hmm. a year on corrections. That's now over $50 billion. In response, they've had less money to spend on things like education. States across the country are feeling the squeeze, and they've started looking as a result for innovative solutions, ways to incarcerate fewer people and to supervise offenders more effectively.
Now, let me go back to a premise. In the last 2 years, the principal story that I've seen from the news services that I subscribe to is our cutbacks within the criminal justice system, our cutbacks in government across the board, but specifically, you know, I'm only interested in the criminal justice system. So I see Illinois laying off 500 state troopers. I see dozens of stories of states closing prisons. I see public defenders complaining bitterly that they don't have the money to conduct business. I see the same thing from prosecutors. The system is being squeezed from all sides. So this becomes a philosophical discussion as well as a fiscal discussion.
That's right. I mean, public safety agencies, like all agencies, you know, have been squeezed in cuts. And you know, in particular areas, I think the court system is one that comes to mind. The cuts have really had a very negative impact,
mm-hmm.
you know, on the ability of the courts to provide justice. You know, I think there's also been, over the course of the past 4 or 5 years, another discussion. And I think that discussion really started in Texas back in 2007.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Texas, as you and your listeners know, is a state which does not shy away from punishment.
No.
It has a very high
state.
Incarceration rate, the
yep.
highest of any big state.
Yep.
And, you know, during the 90s and into the aughts, you know, expanded capacity with great enthusiasm. You know, but in 2007, as a result of an unusual kind of bipartisan coming together of two legislators in particular, the legislature decided not to appropriate funding to further expand the state prison system.
Mm-hmm. The governor wanted to build three more prisons.
The governor and the Texas Department of Criminal Justice wanted to add 14,000 beds to the system.
Right.
Instead, the legislature decided to spend $240 million on treatment and diversion programs.
Mm-hmm.
And there were two things that were really striking about this. You know, one is that it marked a kind of break in the partisan war over crime. I mean, going back to the 60s, I think 1968 was the year that crime emerged as the primary concern in voters' minds.
Right.
And it really sustained that position until about 1994.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very politicized issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what happened in Texas in 2007 showed legislators, both Democrats and Republicans, that that this was something they could work together with. The other striking effect of what Texas did was, you know, their diversion, their investment in treatment worked.
Mm-hmm.
The inmate population leveled off, fell slightly.
Right.
And it demonstrated to states, you know, elsewhere that there was a way to be smarter while still being tough.
Right. But states are doing this, I don't think, from a point of view of a philosophy. I don't think they're looking at it criminologically. I think they're saying to themselves, we've got to stop spending so much money on the prison system. Is there a better way of doing it? And then you have groups like Pew and the Department of Justice and other organizations coming in and saying, yeah, there is a better way of administrating the criminal justice system, right?
There's no doubt that finances is driving the desire to re-examine the criminal justice system,
mm-hmm.
and that the way that politics, that this issue has become depoliticized has also created kind of space to talk about it in a more creative way.
And that's the other really interesting thing, because now you have conservatives and Democrats coming together and they're speaking from the same wavelength. They're speaking from the singing from the same sheet of music, because they want money to build bridges. They want money to go to colleges. They want money to go to schools. And if you keep pouring money into corrections, they don't have that money to spend on other issues.
As difficult as it is to operate in an environment of cuts, you know, I really think that the criminal justice system and some of the reforms that are playing out in the sector, mm-hmm. are a unique bright spot in, mm-hmm. American government. It, mm-hmm. is one of the few areas where legislators, chief executives from both parties have been able to make really meaningful changes.
Right. And everybody's basically saying there's got to be a better way of doing this. Okay, if we're going to be making all these cuts, if we're forced to be making all these cuts, what can we do and what can we do better? And from that, there have been an array of programs that have shown a certain level of success.
There have been. And the literature is fairly clear that, you know, certain interventions, you know, are successful.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most widespread interventions are, of course, drug courts.
Right.
They're cost effective. We're fairly clear on that.
Mm-hmm.
There are now about 2,500 drug courts serving over 100,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
Drug courts, they do work. They're also challenging to ramp up. Personnel intensive. And one of the interesting things that I noticed and which prompted me to write this story was the way in which there are some other types of interventions which really make a virtue of scarcity, of, mm-hmm. limited resources, and which sort of suggest a very effective and very different way of thinking about and responding to public safety issues.
One of the things that I've noted about your article is that it takes a multi-decade approach. It's just not talking about recent events. You go all the way back to the 60s. You go back to incarceration levels. You basically state that there was a certain point where incarceration levels fell beyond a certain point, a point that they were back, I think, in 1962 before crime started skyrocketing. And there's a certain point within the late 1990s where we reached those incarceration levels that existed back in the 1960s. But the question was, do we need to continue that? I mean, how many people do we need to lock up? The criminal justice system in the United States holds about 7 million people, 2 million under incarceration on any given day, a lot more than that in the jail system. So the question becomes, okay, if we cannot afford to sustain that level of incarceration, looking at it from the standpoint of decades in terms of how we got there, what's the better way of doing it?
Well, our society has started to have a conversation about mass incarceration, and it's a very overdue conversation.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, there's been a great deal of completely warranted discussion about mass incarceration's effect on the African American community, particularly,
mm-hmm.
When it comes to young African American men.
Mm-hmm.
The statistics are truly breathtaking. African Americans make up about 15% of the population, but account for 40 to 50%, about 40% of the prison population.
Mm-hmm.
1 in 9 African American men under the age of 34 is in prison.
Mm-hmm.
The Children's Defense Fund estimated about a decade ago that 1 in 3 black men born in 2001 would, on the current trajectory, enter the prison system. Mm-hmm. It's horrifying, and I think that the argument that made by, among others, David Kennedy at John Jay, that we are destroying the village in order to save it, mm-hmm. is correct. Where I am somewhat at odds with the mainstream discussion is why it's happening. Mm-hmm. Probably the most influential book and voice in this debate has been Michelle Alexander's. She's the author of The New Jim Crow. Mm-hmm. And at the risk of simplifying her book, she does make the argument that mass incarceration should be seen as kind of the next step in a long history of American oppression of mm-hmm. minorities. I see it as something which was born of policy decisions taken for understandable reasons in the 1970s, and kind of a story of unintended consequences. In the 1970s, the argument was made by, among others, James Q. Wilson, mm-hmm. Gary Becker, that the U.S. society had made a wrong turn. Faced with rising crime, we were shutting prisons. Mm-hmm. The punitiveness level, mm-hmm. which is what academics calculated, was falling. Mm-hmm. And so, in many ways, the decision to respond to a crime wave by increasing incarceration was a reasonable one. What isn't reasonable, what hasn't been reasonable, is the decision to continue to increase prison capacity, past the point of diminishing returns.
And if you take a look at Department of Justice statistics, half of the states are the population of the prison, their prison systems are declining, but half are increasing.
Yes. I mean, the punitiveness level of the early 60s, was matched in about 1996. So by 1996, we were punishing people at the same rate we were in 1963, mm-hmm. which is the year that Jim Wilson famously described right. as the epoch where everything went wrong.
Right, where crime just took off. I remember in criminological school, once I left the law enforcement profession, and looking at a trend line, and it went up like a rocket in 1963.
Yes, it is. His identification of that as a year to study is certainly correct. Mm-hmm. In addition to my work at Governing, I recently wrote a book called L.A. Noir, which is about the LAPD in this era. It's mm-hmm. a biography of former LAPD chief William Parker. Mm-hmm. And so looking at what happened there, to my mind, it's inescapable that there was a crime response, and that the public demand that there be some public safety response was warranted.
Oh, it was on the cover of every magazine in the country, hundreds and if not thousands of times. The crime issue was the dominant issue in the late 60s and the 70s and the 80s.
But now we've reached a point where, even people like Professor Becker, who were influential in laying the groundwork for thinking about mm-hmm. For applying sort of the Chicago School of Economics to criminology, have concluded that we've gone too far.
Right.
So the question is, how do we pull back? And I think
noting that we have no choice but to pull back at the state level because they can't sustain the level of funding.
States are fed up with sacrificing spending on things like higher education and education in general to build prisons, particularly when the evidence mounts that there are more effective ways to address the problem.
Okay, and that's a good place to break. We're halfway through the program because I do, in the second half of the program, want to talk about those more effective ways. We're talking today to John Bunton. He is with Governing Magazine, www.governing.com. John wrote an article that is being thoroughly discussed within criminal justice circles, and very few people ever have the influence that John's article has had because it's not only extraordinarily well written, easy to read, it goes over a multi-decade worth of research in just four or five pages and comes to some pretty interesting conclusions. His article is How Game Theory is Reinventing Crime Fighting, again, in Governing Magazine, February of 2012. And I'll have the in the show notes the direct link to the article. So, John, let me go back to we've all come collectively through osmosis to a point in the criminal justice system where we say we probably have the low level of incarceration we need. The states can no longer afford to really do any more. So we now have a programmatic approach. We're now trying to figure out, we within the criminological community, led by the Department of Justice, led by Pew, led by lots of organizations, we're now coming to grips with an alternative way of conducting business. So give me a sense of Project Hope in Hawaii.
Well, so a lot of attention is paid in these discussions to the prison system, to the 2.3 million people who are incarcerated mm-hmm. in prisons. Understandably so, but often we ignore the fact that a larger number, about 5 million people, are in community supervision.
Right.
And one of the fascinating things about Project Hope is the way in which, in a very cost-effective way, it's sketched out an approach to dealing with probation, which allows the system to address a very large number of offenders, a much mm-hmm. larger number of offenders than a typical drug court can mm-hmm. address, in a strikingly effective way. It also has a really fascinating personal story.
Mm-hmm.
So back in 2004, Judge Stephen Alm got interested in the caseload that he'd been assigned. Mm-hmm. He'd been on the bench for about 3 years. Mm-hmm. He was an unusual figure.
Mm-hmm.
He was a former U.S. attorney.
Mm-hmm.
He is an ex-boxer. In mm-hmm. fact, he had even fought in his youth at the Central Jail in Hawaii.
Interesting.
Yes, if you ever encounter him, ask him what episode of Hawaii Five-0 he was on. And when he looked at his docket, he asked a kind of obvious question that only a relatively new judge who'd had a broad experience would ask, which is, you're asking me to remand all these people to prison custody
right.
after they've amassed, 20, 25 violations.
Right.
Why am I only dealing with this now?
Right.
He said, think about parenting. If you have a kid, what would happen if when your kid acted out, you didn't do anything?
Mm-hmm.
You didn't do anything. You mm-hmm. ignored violation after violation.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly and arbitrarily, the hammer came down
right.
and you inflicted an extreme punishment on the
right.
kid.
Right, right, right.
It wouldn't work very well. It's not a good way to parent. And
right.
your kid would feel like they were being mistreated.
Right.
And that is basically what he argued the criminal justice system was doing. So he came up with a different approach, which was guided by, a couple of simple precepts. One was that punishment should be swift and certain,
mm-hmm.
but not necessarily severe.
Mm-hmm.
So you fail your drug test, you miss your appointment, you're going to go into jail, not for 2 years,
right?
For 2 weekends, perhaps.
Right.
If you have a job, well, then you'll serve your jail time on the weekends.
Right.
And because he had been a U.S. attorney, he was able to call in some favors,
mm-hmm.
for instance, appealing to the U.S. Marshals to make warrant enforcement a priority for his court.
Right.
In other words, to make good his threat.
They track the guy down and put him in jail.
Yes.
For a positive drug test.
Yes.
And they did it over and over and over again until they stopped pulling positive drug tests.
Well, two things happened that were interesting. One was he decided instead of just having a drug test every now and again, everyone in my court is going to call an 800 number every morning, and that 800 number will tell you whether you have to come in for a drug test that very day.
Interesting.
And if you were called in, you were tested on the spot, results were generated on the spot, and if you failed, you could even go into custody on the spot.
That day.
It was a rather shocking innovation,
mm-hmm.
and one of the things that resulted from this was a dramatic fall off in positive drug tests.
Well, a dramatic fall off in positive drug test, a dramatic fall off in the behavior that sends people to prison, and startling in terms of recidivism rates, with recidivism as defined by new arrest or new incarcerations, that dropped dramatically as well.
It did, yes. I mean, the drug test positive fall off rate was in the vicinity of 80%.
Mm-hmm.
Recidivism dropped around 50%.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another component of the HOPE experience that's really fascinating, and it was this. Once you demonstrated that the threat, if you will, was
mm-hmm.
credible,
mm-hmm.
you didn't have to enforce it
right.
very frequently.
Right.
Most people quickly got the message this was real. And as a result, you didn't have to expend a lot of organizational capacity enforcing.
Right.
And that has allowed him to, you know, expand the number of people supervised.
So basically what we have here is a set of circumstances where literally over time, thousands of individuals who were headed back to the prison system didn't go back to the prison system. You have literally thousands of crimes over time now, okay, considering the length of the program, of people who did not come back into contact with the criminal justice system. I know not all crimes are reported, so that's a very iffy proposition. But we certainly know and can speculate that there were a lot of crimes that were not committed because they stopped drugs and they also got themselves involved in treatment.
And what connects us to the wonderful world of game theory is the way in which Hawaii, or at least Judge Ohm's caseload, moved from a very unsatisfactory equilibrium with a lot of frequent offenders
mm-hmm.
to a very virtuous equilibrium
mm-hmm.
where you didn't have to do much enforcement and you didn't have much offense.
Right.
And, you know, that's something that we've seen, you know, not only in programs like HOPE, but in other parts of the criminal justice world, you know, particularly with some of the Operation Ceasefire style drug market interventions.
Right. And that's the other thing I wanted to bring up. David Kennedy and a variety of others, including ourselves here at Court Services and Offender Supervision Agency, what we have tried to do is to focus on the bad actors. And here it gets back. Oh, and one of the things with Project HOPE, these were high risk offenders. These were not low risk offenders.
Yes, these were high risk offenders.
Okay.
You know, Judge Ohm, in recent months, years, has done something very interesting as well. I believe that he's currently in the process of bringing a drug court, you know, into his caseload as well.
Mm-hmm.
And in effect, one of the striking results has been that a surprisingly large number of people in his system are able to stop using without undergoing the type of expensive drug treatment that drug courts typically provide in an earlier stage.
Mm-hmm.
So Judge Ohm has sought to sort of use the drug court in the more intensive treatment
mm-hmm.
for that subset of offenders, you know, who he believes is actually quite a small subset,
right,
who really don't respond to these swift but certain sanctions.
Mm-hmm. Rand, a long time ago, basically said that many offenders take vacations from drugs. I mean, we have this sense that drugs are, you know, you cannot kick drugs, and offenders stop using drugs all the time. So, and drugs are heavily correlated with the amount of criminal activity that you do. But get back to David Kennedy, because one of the things that Kennedy seemed to have done and others throughout the years is to say, you know, one of the things that we should be doing is focusing on, again, the high risk offenders. Not everybody within the criminal justice system, but the really bad actors and going after them, correct?
Correct. I mean, I think David Kennedy's insights has been that in most cities, people talk about problems like gang violence or talk about problems like drug markets, but that when you convene the players, the agencies who are trying to address the problem, and you ask, let's drill down to the individual level. You know, typically a fairly small subset
mm-hmm.
of people are responsible for the most violence. And, you know, Kennedy you know, first originally in Boston back in the early 90s, came onto the scene of, you know, a pre-existing kind of intervention. Mm-hmm. The Boston Police Department, court probation, the Department of Youth Services, you know, a kind of group had already sort of come together and was working across agency to deliver a message mm-hmm. to certain violent offenders mm-hmm. That if they persisted in doing violent things, they get a lot of attention, right. Unwelcome attention.
Right.
And Kennedy, to his great credit, recognized that there's something very interesting happening here. I mean, most academics will tell you that that criminals are not highly rational. Mm-hmm. Crime doesn't pay well. Mm-hmm. We know that, you know, contrary to public perception, drug dealing for most people, you know, is basically a minimum wage job.
I've never seen such poverty in my life than in a drug dealer's homes, yet every television show I see shows just the opposite.
And so the notion that, you know, gangbangers who, as we know, police frequently refer to as knuckleheads mm-hmm. Will respond in a rational fashion was a little bit of a stretch. Mm-hmm. You know, in Boston, David tried it, you know. The first element was concentration, which mm-hmm. you've described as focusing on the high-risk people. You know, David and his group added to that something interesting, which was a direct message. Mm-hmm. You know, that was probably best illustrated in High Point, North Carolina, which had a very robust open-air drug market in the African-American West End. Mm-hmm. The police did traditional police work. They got all the information they needed to, you know, round up a group of the biggest dealers.
Right.
But instead of arresting them and seeing them replaced by their understudies, mm-hmm. they called them in and mm-hmm. they delivered a message saying, we know what you're doing. We have these binders. We're ready to prosecute.
Right.
But instead, we'd like to suggest something else. You shut down the drug market.
Right.
And, you know, identifying exactly who the actors were, communicating a clear threat, was very effective. You know, it shut down High Point, and in Boston, at least for a while, you know, it shut down the kind of epidemic levels of youth violence that were making news throughout.
And the threat was that the one instance within the article that an offender had a bullet in the pocket, which is a felon in possession of a bullet, which is prohibited, and he goes to prison for 15 years.
Kennedy brought in the U.S. attorney, which was very supportive, and they decided to make an example of one gangbanger. So, yes, right. He was found with a bullet. And that
influenced everybody else.
Federal time was a powerful threat.
So, in essence, we have to wrap up. We're really about a minute and a half left before I have to close. What the article says, looking at it from a multi-decade point of view, looking at a variety of philosophies, a variety of points of view, it says principally what?
The article says that we should concentrate our resources on the worst offenders. Mm-hmm. We should bear in mind that the world is dynamic, and we should think about how we can tip criminal activity from a bad cycle, which we're all familiar with, mm-hmm. the cycle of reoffending, the cycle of recidivism, the cycle of, you know, failed probation visits. Mm-hmm. A third of prison, of the prisoners going into the prison systems are there because of probation violations. Mm-hmm. And we should think about ways to create virtuous circles. And that if we communicate our expectations clearly and carry through on those on our message, you know, we can see some really startling changes in behavior. We can move to a virtuous equilibrium, which doesn't require a great deal of resources to maintain. And very importantly, we can also create a sense of fairness. The system seems fair, mm-hmm. because while I've talked a lot about deterrence, mm-hmm. That sense of fairness is also very important. And a lot of the most interesting work now in criminology, I think, is occurring around those issues of fairness and legitimacy.
We're approaching the criminal justice system with a surgeon's tool instead of a sledgehammer.
Exactly, yes.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, our guest today has been, and it's been a pleasure interviewing you, John, and reading your article, John Button. Governing magazine, www.governing.com. He wrote what I consider to be a groundbreaking article, How Game Theory is in Reinventing Crime Fighting. Ladies and gentlemen, this is DC Public Safety. We really do appreciate all of the cards, letters, emails, phone calls, suggesting new programs, comments, criticisms. If you have suggestions for new shows, we would love to hear them, and we want everybody to have yourselves a very, very pleasant day.